Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Thank you, Eddie C., and welcome to the program, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Kevin McCory, in for Cherry Gregg.
Accents, Kevin?
Yeah.
We all have them. But why? And how do accents develop? That's the topic of the show today. And a little tease for you.
Yeah.
The American accent. Do you know which party is perhaps most responsible for what we might consider the standard American accent?
I guess I would naively guess England.
They're responsible for why we speak English. But right. I'm talking about the difference between how Americans talk and how British people talk, for instance.
Oh, I don't know what you mean by party, Avi. I'm sorry.
The Pennsylvania Quakers.
Ah.
We'll get to that later in the show. We also have a question for you. How would you describe your accent? Have you been judged for the way you talk? We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And it's Thursday, so that means DJ of the day. Think of a song on the theme of today's main segment, accents, talking. Email your pick to studio2@whyy.org. And while Avi is interviewing our expert today, I'll be sorting through your choices to pick a winner that will play at the end of the show. And bonus alert, everybody who emails us today will get a chance to win a pair of passes to the Sing Us Home Festival that's happening in Manayunk next weekend.
It's a 3-day concert experience, Friday, May 1st through Sunday, May 3rd. Shows by the Menzingers, the Mountain Goats, Ted Leo, Dave Howes, and many more performing on beautiful Venice Island in Manayunk. Bet you didn't know there was an island in Manayunk. A pair of weekend tickets to Sing Us Home is a $326 value, so you get your emails in at studio2@whyy.org for a chance to win access to this great homegrown festival. Get those nominations in.
Yeah, first, though, a trio of local news stories, as always. All that opioid settlement money we've been hearing about for years, well, a lot less of it is going to individuals than previously thought. Great investigative journalism piece out today by ProPublica and The Inquirer showing that fewer than half of the 140,000 people who filed claims against Purdue Pharma will get a payout under a revised bankruptcy settlement plan. The reporting dug up the fact that the new deal slashed payments for victims and imposed tougher eligibility requirements. So payouts to families of fatal overdose victims dropped to as little as $8,000, where the previous payouts had been more like $48,000, Abby.
And you mentioned the change in the standard of proof. It used to be that victims could submit a sworn affidavit telling their story. Yep. Now they have to dig up medical or legal records to show opioid purchase. And you can imagine this is from many, many years ago. That's difficult for many people to do. And another part of the story is that the settlement agreements were negotiated, you know, out of the public eye for many, many months. And so people in our area, and our area has been hit really, really hard by the opioid crisis. A lot of people in our area were taken by surprise when these changes came to light. And so you feel when you read this so terrible for the folks who felt they were going to get at least some compensation for what their families have gone through and now maybe looking at zilch.
Right. And they're looking at the lawyers who have been making bank through all this process. And they're also feeling, I think, that it was never about the money as much as it was about
a token
to show that they have been wronged and that someone is being held accountable.
Yeah. And this is a perennial problem with these large settlements. How do you weed out applicants? Of course, you don't want people to defraud the process. So there is another side to this. But I personal experience in my family, someone who's trying to get money from a settlement that has to do with nuclear radiation exposure from a nuclear test, and trying to prove that you live somewhere when these tests were happening, it's incredibly difficult to go back and find records from years and years and years ago for anyone, even the most well-connected, well-accessed people. So that's a real problem, I think, in lots of settlement cases.
Yeah. Story number two, Avi.
So this one went a little bit under the radar, but last month, Philly signed a deal with the genealogy company Ancestry.com, and as a result, millions of records sitting in city archives right now will be digitized and eventually available online. We're talking birth records, property records, marriage certificates, a whole trove of info, some of it dating back to the 1600s.
Wow.
And Ancestry is doing this digitization work for free, or at least no cost to the city. So it seems like a great deal for Philly. However, there's another side. Technically, Philly had an interesting report about who really owns these digital copies. And there is a pending court case in Pennsylvania right now about state records that revolves around this issue. Now, in Philadelphia, the OG paper records will still belong to the city. But there's an open question about, well, does Ancestry then own the digital byproducts of the digitization process, like the metadata? Do they own the search tools used to access this data? And if they do, are these now kind of public-private records? Are they still public records? So that's sort of a side story to this broader story of we're soon going to have access, it seems, to many, many more records related to the history of Philadelphia.
Right. And up until now, if you wanted access to these records, you could get them. You could go down to the office.
Wasn't easy, yeah.
Right?
Wasn't easy.
Wait in line and go through the whole bureaucracy of getting a public record from a public office. And this really will create a lot more ease. And maybe you can argue in a perfect world, Avi, like the city government would be spending money to create its own database. But of all the priorities the city has, is that the one that we should be focusing on? And then once it's public, it's going to be crawled by these private companies anyway. There's nothing that's going to stop the private company from searching public records. That's how they make this business anyway. So I'm not really sure if there's some fix that's going to prevent
there's a better solution.
And in this case, they're paying for it. So it seems kind of like a win-win from where I sit.
It's a win for me as a history nerd. I know that because I'm very excited to see what turns up. And I will say that digitization of records really does change the game. It makes history far more public. And when history is in its paper form, usually just a handful of very dedicated archivists and historians can access it and interpret it. And once something becomes digital, it really does open the inquiry up to everybody who has a computer. And that's a pretty magical process.
Yeah, super excited to be able to start digging into those archives.
Also excited about
story number three.
Yes.
They're young, they're hot, they're physical, they're on ice. No, it's not the hit HBO show. It's your 2026 Philadelphia Flyers. The orange and black are one win away from a playoff series sweep of the hated rival Pittsburgh Penguins. And things were bonkers last night, Avi, at the hockey arena in South Philly. This was the first playoff win for the Flyers since April of 2016. Barack Obama was president, Avi.
First home win.
Home win, I'm sorry. And Gritty got the place rocking last night by beating up a 6-foot penguin and throwing it off the upper deck.
Yeah, toss that thing, Gritty. Throw it! Kill him! Oh, he's holding it above his head. Oh, there it goes. Goodbye, Penguin. Fall of the Penguin.
That kicked off the big 5-2 win last night. Next game is Saturday. Like I said, they can close it out. And like other recent Philly playoff runs, this team has come together around a locker room victory song. Avi, let's hear a little bit of that song. Just come be the man. So that's Man I Need by breakout British singer-songwriter Olivia Dean, Avi.
I like that groove.
It's a groove.
It sounded familiar. This is so funny. Unplanned. You're wearing orange and I'm wearing black.
Whoa!
What the heck's going on with that? We're flyered up and we didn't even know it. All right. So I like that song.
Yeah.
Man I Need. I do love this trend, which has been bubbling in recent years, of teams having like a locker room victory song or a song associated with their playoff run. I decided to go back over the last few years and rank my favorites.
Okay. Let's hear them.
So number five, there was for the Eagles team that made it to the Super Bowl but didn't win, there was the song Just Wanna Rock by Lil Uzi Vert.
Okay.
Pretty good. It didn't really catch on as wide, but it's a good bop and he's from Philly.
Sure.
Number four, I'll put Man I Need by Olivia Dean. Only because I don't want to be a prisoner of the moment, but the Flyers have to get a little deeper in the playoffs for this thing to really stick. Okay, so they're four right now, but the potential to move up. Number three was tough. I went with Blow the Whistle for the last Eagles Super Bowl win, made popular by Gilly the King. And it was super popular, and there was a dance that went with it, which was great. But it didn't come from the players. It kind of came from outside, so I had to dock it for that. Number two, I went with Dancing on My Own.
Ooh.
Phillies when they made the World Series.
Sure.
I docked it a little, and this is painful for me because it's a cover of the original version by Robin, right. And that always rubbed me a little bit the wrong way.
You want Robin to get more due.
Can you guess number one?
Dreams and Nightmares by Meek Mill.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For the first Eagles Super Bowl run, easily number one. First of all, Meek's from Philly. That song caught on everywhere. It just had such an energy to it. The players were totally bought in on it. You could hear people playing it on the street and boom boxes. Yeah. I mean, that one for me, I don't know if anything will ever top Dreams and Nightmares when it comes to victory songs associated with great Philadelphia sports teams. A very niche category, but that's my pick, Kevin.
Yeah, that's a great pick. Yeah, I'm going to shout out something recently. You know the Brayson Scott song that they play at the ballpark? Yeah. A-O-A-O-K. Yeah. Well, apparently the Phillies are doing so bad that he has dropped that song. Things are not A-O-K anymore.
Dang.
And he has a new walk-up song that's like the country twang pickup truck vibe. So if I'm just thinking about what songs that make you feel good in the Philly music universe, that one always kind of made me feel good. Kind of got the crowd going.
Well, it's not working, Bryson.
It's not working.
Switch it back, my man. So we're going to go out on another song, I believe, that is a part of the Philly sports lore, which was Ain't No Stopping Us Now.
Right.
Which was associated, I think, with like
the 1980 Phillies and the 80-81 Eagles. They had versions specifically made with lyrics about those
And the
teams.
Song's from Philly. The song's from Philly.
It was a big hit in 79 and kind of rolled into 80 and McFadden and Whitehead.
Oh, there ain't no stopping Studio 2 now. We're going to talk about accents on the other side of this break. We'd love to hear your accent stories. A great email or two already came in. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off for the week. I got her number. How do you like them apples? Now, when I say it, that line falls more than a little flat. But when Matt Damon's character says it in the movie Good Will Hunting with an accent as thick as Boston fog, it is the perfect coda to a scene about class division and class assumptions in America, and it's also just a pretty funny line. We all notice the subtle differences in how people talk. In fact, we are hardwired to notice them. But why? And how do these accents develop? Why do Americans sound different than Brits? Why do Philadelphians sound different than New Yorkers? What silent rules govern accent creation, and how do we end up assigning social value to these seemingly arbitrary distinctions? Those questions are at the heart of a new book by our guest today. Valerie Friedland is a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada. Her new book is called Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. Valerie, welcome back to Studio 2.
Well, thank you. And I applaud your pronunciation of Nevada.
I had to hit that one.
I could see it was painful, but you did a good job.
I had to hit that one. And our question for you out there listening, how would you describe your accent? Have you been judged for the way you talk? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat. Let's read this comment from Ruth, who says, I am lucky I can adapt my accent to wherever I am. While in college in Nashville, I was asked several times which part of Nashville I was from. I told them the Philadelphia area, and we laughed. I have a basic Norristown accent, except with a little Philly mixed in there. So I thought this was actually a perfect way to set up the conversation with you, Valerie, and I wanted to talk about your accent and how you developed it. And I was hoping you could help me out here just by saying a sample sentence that I've constructed here. So I want you to repeat this sentence. Don't worry. It's easy. It's easy. The sentence is, I ordered a huge funnel cake and a bottle of water.
I ordered a huge funnel cake and a bottle of water.
Okay. So let's break down your accent because I didn't pick up a whole lot there, but I bet you did. What did you pick up from that sentence, and how do you describe your own accent?
You know, I think like many, many people, I feel like I had a lot of different inputs into my accent. And, you know, I don't have one that people call out as being from a particular place, even though there are some slight southern accent features in it. But part of my accent story is that I grew up in Tennessee, which clearly is a place people think of as accented. But I had parents that came from somewhere else. They were both French speaking. And, you know, at the time I was growing up, they were kind of exotic. And people sort of always asked them where they were from. And I think having that mix early on where we were kind of the outsiders, and I went to school at a school there where a lot of kids that were from outside of the South went. So I think that did dampen some of the accented features from the South in my speech. But if you ever get me either drinking or tired.
Which one are you well, right now, Valerie?
Well, I'm drinking, but it's only tea.
It.
I can't say I'm not tired. But anyway, it will slip out. And I think that's a lot of people's experiences. Yep. They have these different levels of their accent and maybe even different inputs. They've lived in different places. But really, the accent of home, the one we grew up with, those are the features that really define our authentic accent. And then we kind of take piecemeal segments from other accents as we experience them, particularly if we spend, repeated exposure to that accent. So if you relocated to Nashville and you're really with a group of people that you want to identify with, you'll probably pick up some of their features.
Absolutely.
Even though Nashville is pretty urban, so it doesn't have a strong Southern accent anymore. But we are all kind of really accent savants in many ways, where we pick up things that are noticeable, but we're also not that great at sort of just picking up that whole, like, I couldn't move to Philly and become a Philly accented speaker. I might be able to say water, but that's about it.
Yeah, you would just get a little bit of a flavor. And by the way, on that point, here's a comment from Chris from East Hampton who says, I'm originally from the Bronx, but now live in New Jersey. Whenever I go back, I code switch back to my Bronx accent. So part of it is where you're living, where you move to, but also the context of who you're speaking with. And there's a lot of inputs you mentioned, Valerie, but the reason I asked you about your accent is because of your parents. Because in my mind, one of the big questions about an individual's accent is how much of it is society and how much of it is what you get from your parents at home. And you reference in this book this fascinating study about people in Philadelphia. Kids who moved before age 4 to Philadelphia developed Philly accents. But in addition to that, those with parents also from Philly were the only ones who were able to replicate all aspects of the local accent perfectly, while those with out-of-state parents, even if they moved to Philly very early, could not, which tells us that local accents start forming before we're even born. So explain how that could be possible.
Okay, so much in that to unpack. The first thing is this idea that as parents, we have a really substantial impact on our children's speech. And as anybody who's ever raised children knows, while you wish you did, especially in those teenage years, the really strong influence on children tends to be their peer group. In terms of accent, babies do really learn from their parents in terms of the initial system that they will have. So they get the input of the speech around them, which tends to be parents more than anything. And that kind of helps cement what are the categories of the language I'm going to speak. What's the sort of general melody? And even babies in utero seem to get some of that input from their mother. But by the time you hit preschool and you're hanging out with way cooler friends than your parents, that you really start to do something that in fancy linguists lingo we call vernacular reorganization, which is simply a big word for we start to model ourselves off of their behavior, and that includes language, which is why I don't speak with a French accent, even though that's what my parents had. I speak with the language of my peers, with the accent of my peers, because that's really the important aspect that I attend to there.
We're asking you this hour, how would you describe your accent? Have you been judged for the way you talk? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Let me read this comment from Karen, who says, I grew up in Buffalo, where the accent is very much like the Midwestern accent with a very flat A. When I went off to college and met up with young people from all along the East Coast, I felt regarded as a hick because of my accent. Needless to say, I lost that flat A pretty quickly. Of course, I'll add that when I first moved to Philly and somebody asked me where he could find what sounded to me like a towel, I realized words like towel and water are pronounced differently here. So really interesting story from Karen, and gets at that idea of social pressure being something that drives the way we speak. So let's unpack that a little bit. Why do we feel like What about humans? What about our brains makes us want to conform to the linguistic norms around us? What would be the evolutionary purpose of that?
You know, if we look back in time, accents have existed as long as humans have been talking. And, you know, part of the development of accents is simply sort of the natural evolution of language as it moves through the mouths and the minds of speakers. So, you know, you think about maybe 100,000 years ago and language would have just started and we probably had just one language, maybe a couple, but basically, we typically think it probably started from one language. Well, as, you know, 50,000 years ago, the waves of migration started out of Africa. Different groups settled in different places, and they didn't have iPhones back then, so they weren't calling each other up. No YouTube, sorry. So they didn't really see each other anymore, and their, you know, their survival was really dependent on being able to gel as a community and, you know, small bands of, you know, tribal members, and also recognize potential danger. Well, a key way to do that would have been to recognize someone from the sound of their voice. So even from far away, you could tell if they were one of your tribe or not. And if they weren't, then maybe get the hell out of Dodge, as they might say.
Yep.
Right. So these little changes that happen in our speech, and I think, you know, a great example of this is just the way, you know, the word water. If you're British and you're sort of upper class, you'll say water. But if you're from Philly, obviously you say water, or however a true Philly accent would say
it. That was pretty good.
Not too bad. If you're from, you know, a lot of Midland America, you'd say water. If you're a Cockney, you'll say wa-a. Well, all of those sounds, right, all of that sort of that T in the middle that we think of as T, it's actually not T in many accents because of some natural tendencies in the way that stressed and unstressed syllables come together. So it's really linguistically normal for that to change. But how it develops depends really on who you're hanging out with, and you'll pick up whatever version of the variant the people around you say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you accumulate a bunch of differences like this when you're all talking together, then over time, that's what we hear as an accent. And it marks social meaning and group signaling for us. And so part of that is simply in early times survival, because you wanted to see who was going to be collaborative and who may be dangerous. But it really also bonds us with the people that we talk with and flock with. And so just like styles of dressing and, you know, certain behavior traits that we pick up and cultural patterns from the people we love and we spend time with, language is fundamental to that process.
Yeah. It bonds
there's
us.
Very few things.
Yeah. It bonds us to the people around us, and, you know, in early times made us suspicious of people who might want to do us harm. And like, it's not the only thing, like you mentioned, there are other cultural traits, but this is a very fundamental one because it's something we all do. And I think it's really important to mention, as you point out in the book, it's something that we're able to pick up on almost immediately. Like, our brains are so good at picking up accents. Explain how good.
Amazingly good. You know, and we're not always right in our judgments, but we do, when we hear something that sounds different than we expect, we very rapidly, within about 400 milliseconds, which is about the time it takes to say hello, start to associate social clues that we get from accents, from the way that vowels are pronounced,
for
example.
It's so automatic. It's so automatic.
So that, you know, it's sort of part of our nature. And we find actually young children, so at 5 months old, we can see that babies respond differently to accents from their home versus accents that they're not familiar with. So it seems like it's something pre-wired in us to recognize these differences. And that's probably that evolutionary advantage of group signaling it offered way, way back when. But we're very rapid in making associations between accents and social categories. And, you know, that's not necessarily always a good thing because it brings up social triggers and stereotypes. But it also isn't a bad thing because it helps us recognize the shared experience of people that we have something, you know, linguistically at least in common with.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring that up because later in the show, we will certainly get into some of the downsides of our perceptive abilities when it comes to accents. But it's worth noting that this isn't necessarily a conscious choice. I mean, this is really deeply baked into our brains. I want to bring in a caller now. This is Will from Westchester on the line. And by the way, we're asking you today, how would you describe your accent? Do you think you get judged for the way you talk? It could be positive or negative. 888-477-9499, the email studio2@whyy.org. Will, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your thoughts.
I'm a huge fan of your show. And
thanks, Will.
I'm from Minnesota. Thank you. I'm from Minnesota, and after the movie Fargo came out, everybody had an opinion about my accent. people in Philadelphia have been some of the nicest people about it because I think they know they have a little bit of an accent too. But everybody's always like, you know, oh, what's that, a boot, and everything else. And it's just been really funny to be from Minnesota my whole life.
Do you think people assume you're friendlier, Will?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because that's an association that a lot of people have with Minnesota. That's a great call. Thank you so much, Will. So I want to talk about how accents develop. So part of it, right, is like some group gets geographically isolated and they develop a different way of speaking, right? But there are also some interesting kind of unspoken rules about how accents develop. And you lay out a couple in the book. One is sort of like ease of articulation and one is ease of perception. So when we're coming up with novel ways of speaking, there actually seem to be some rules governing like why we go down the paths we go down. Is that right?
Yes. And I mean, not rules in the sense of, you know, the schoolroom rules that you learn, like don't end sentences with a preposition, but more cognitive principles that we follow and articulatory principles that we follow. So ease of articulation really governs a lot of changes that we see in language and a lot of things that we complain about in language, because it leads us to be more efficient in the way that we're putting sounds together in speech. And just like that example of how people pronounce the T in water, when I said it's, you know, when it comes between a stressed and unstressed syllable, well, it's more efficient to actually rapidly articulate the T in that context, which is why we don't really often say water, because that actually takes a lot longer. To be more efficient, it makes sense from an ease of articulation standpoint to just say either water, where you don't have the T, or something like water, where it's a much more rapid hitting of the tongue against the alveolar ridge, if you want to get fancy.
Let's
get fancy. So that's really what governs a lot of things we do, is just making them easier to say. And the trick is, if we just followed that principle, of course, the problem people would say, it would be, okay, well, if you always just try and make things easier to say, then they're going to be hard to understand.
Exactly.
But that's where ease of perception comes in. And so ease of perception guides us in a number of ways. First of all, it helps determine what kinds of sounds stick around in language more commonly. So for example, TH is a pretty rare sound in world languages. About only 8% of languages have it. And part of that seems to stem from the fact that it's really hard to perceive compared to other sounds. So a T or duh has a lot more perceptual acuity than a th. And so over time, languages that have th often turn them into t or d. And that's probably from an ease of perception standpoint. But also just in general, when we're doing that ease of articulation thing, we have a sense as a speaker of a certain accent or language of how much is too much. And so we allow ease of articulation to operate only so much as we can be understood by the group that we want to be understood by. Mm. And of course, the problem with this sometimes is that if you're not in that group, you might be like, I have no idea what you're saying. And I think the Philly jeet yet, you know, yeah. Jeet kind of is one of those things, like an outsider might be jeet what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they might not get it.
It's right on the edge of being able to be perceived, especially if you're not in the in group.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's an ease of articulation, ease of perception kind of balance yep. there. And so these two principles really are fundamentally responsible for every single change we see in language, pretty much.
Let me bring in another caller. This is Chris from Chicago. Do I have that right, Chris? Are you from Chicago originally? You're actually calling us from Chicago right now.
Yes. No, I'm in Philadelphia now, but I grew up in Chicago. I've been here for 4 years. And the thing I've noticed about the accent here is that, and this may be a little elitist, but it's almost borderline wrong the way many things are said. I mean, there's no O's in water. You know, there's G. You're just skipping words. At what point do we consider this just wrong and no longer an accent?
Right.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Great question. So this is so fundamental to the book. I think what you're going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, Valerie, is there really is no such thing as wrong, because the target is constantly moving. Now, the target that Chris is using there is what we might consider a sort of standard American accent. And we're going to explain in a second how that accent developed and how Pennsylvania played a key role. But let's address Chris's question. At what point is a pronunciation just wrong?
Well, all I can say is that spoken like a true Chicagoan. to say that, right? So, I mean, it's funny because a lot of people from Chicago don't think they have an accent at all, but anybody not from Chicago hearing someone from Chicago talk can instantly tag it as, you know, that's definitely an accented speaker. The reality is none of us think we have an accent if we are from a member of a sort of upper class group or middle class group that speaks what is considered sort of an accentless norm. Now, that doesn't really exist, but in our imagination, it does. And so we compare all other accents, especially local kind of provincial ones, to that one, and then usually judge them harshly for it. The reality is the same pressures, you know, that ease of articulation, ease of perception, and historical, you know, accumulation of small changes created every single accent of every single speaker, and every single person has one. And there is no such thing from a linguistic standpoint of a linguistically superior accent or something that is wrong, because if you look through the evolution of how every speech feature came to be, there's a long story behind it and often a history. And a lot of what people think of as wrong pronunciations actually historically or maybe even the older one. So a perfect example of that is saying axe for ask. That actually is a colonial relic, and it's not a bastardization of English. People think it's wrong because of the associations with the social group of those who speak it, yep. But it itself is historically quite fine.
Yeah, it's actually in some ways a more conservative development of the language because it's conserving something that has since gone away. I want to talk real. We have some great callers on the line, but before we get to a break, I did tease this. The American accent, or what we might consider a standard, I'm putting air quotes there, American accent. And you talk in the book about how it developed from the British way of speaking. And Pennsylvania really played an important role here. The Pennsylvania Quakers played an important role here. I would love for you to tell that story for our audience, many of whom are probably descended from Pennsylvania Quakers.
Yes. Well, gosh, that's a lot to live up to because you've teased how Pennsylvania is pivotal. So I better make it important, right?
Make it important. Know your audience.
Right, exactly. The Mid-Atlantic dialect region of which Philly is a part really was established with the coming of the Quakers, who were mainly from the north of England and also Irish, a lot of Irish settlers from there. But it wasn't just the Quakers that were foundational to the accent of the Mid-Atlantic. It was also slightly later arrivals from Germany and the Scots-Irish who came by way of Ireland, but were really from the lowlands of Scotland originally. And it's really those three groups that together forge what we think of as sort of that mid-Atlantic and even Midwestern dialect, especially, you know, if you look at the divides between the lower and upper Midlands. What's really fascinating there is a lot of times, like in Ohio or Illinois, people from the north of those states think they speak a certain way and they, you know, look down upon the southern part of the state and vice versa. And it's really because as from the Mid-Atlantic colonies, the settlers spread westward, it was the Germans that stayed sort of in the upper Midlands and the Scots-Irish that settled the lower Midland. And that's really why you get that weird divide through the Midland.
Right.
But in Philadelphia, really, the Quakers with their Irish and Northern English background were pivotal to the accent that would develop there. Now, we didn't hear people say the same accent they're using today, but the basically cultural and linguistic sort of founding effect was present very early on.
But also the fact that the Quakers were proponents of religious tolerance and that drew groups from Germany, from Ireland, et cetera. I mean, that's important to the mixing that then becomes this distinct accent from the accent of the British aristocracy. Do I have that about right, Valerie?
Absolutely. I mean, really the key, the bread and butter of accent is interaction, and whoever is interacting in really productive and sort of community-based ways, they'll develop sort of forged speech features that make them sound more similar, and then they'll be different from people outside that area. And in New England, for example, where you had a lot of sort of Southern British settlement early on, they didn't tend to be nearly as open to other settlers, not even other Puritans, right? There was a lot of infighting in that group.
right. So they were a little more closed. The Quakers were a little more open, and that is why that meeting point in Pennsylvania becomes so important to the creation of what we might call the American accent. So we're going to a break right now. We got some great calls and emails, really fascinated to get to some of this stuff on the other side of this break. We're asking you this hour, how would you describe your accent? Have you been judged for the way you talk? Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And we will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine is helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Sherry Gregg is off for the week. This hour, we've been talking about the way we talk, about the history of accents, how they develop and spread, and what they reveal about where we come from. University of Nevada linguist Valerie Friedland is our guest. She has a new book out called Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. And we'd love to hear from you. How would you describe your accent? Have you been judged for the way you talk? Our number is 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Joseph from Middletown has been patiently waiting on line two. Joseph, you're on Studio 2. I'd love to hear your accent perspective.
Yes, thanks for introducing. This is Joseph. So I was born and raised in Sierra Leone in West Africa. And so coming from a region in the world where there are so many accents, English is happens to be the third language I learned to speak. So living in America, they always tell me you have a strong accent. Well, in my mind, I'm saying to myself, if you came to live where I live and you try to speak any of the languages that I've been speaking so fluently, you will have an accent too.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where we come off with accents. We probably speak differently, but somebody has an accent. It depends on when you go to live in another region where your language is not the primary language that's being spoken.
That's a great call, Joseph, in Middletown. And there's a whole section of this book about accents for people who are non-native speakers and why they are so stubborn. I want you to try to explain that to the listeners, Valerie, because what's so fascinating to me is that we have people who achieve almost super fluency in a second language. I mean, they're incredibly, incredibly fluent. And yet an accent often persists. That doesn't go away. How does that happen?
My parents, for example, lived here most of their adult lives. They both left where they were from when they were, 18 or 19, and lived in the United States for 50 years and had accents till the very end. So accents are very hard to shake because we start learning the system that will be the language we speak and the specific accent we speak very young. As we talked about, even in utero, you start getting that melody down. And then, you go to school, you have these cool friends and you sound like them. By around 18 or 19, the system we're going to have as adults is pretty much set.
Yep.
And it's really hard to get away from some of those fundamental categories that we've learned. So which vowels we have, what consonants we have. And it's easy to move someplace and pick up some aspects of that accent. So I can, move to the South and I can say y'all, or move to Philly and say water. I might even be able to articulate a few idiosyncratic vowels here or there, or sounds that are made. So I could go to Britain and say water here and there to sound fancy. But I can't do it systematically. I can't do it like those speakers. So in that study you talked about in Philadelphia, a lot of the kids that moved there were able to come up with, pretty good approximates of the Philly accent. But if you actually measured how they were doing it, it wasn't accurate to the local pattern, which in Philly is actually very, very complex. And so what we find is people pick up parts of that, but not all of that. And especially when you come from a different language background, the leap between what you're sounding like, the sounds of your language and the variants, and the sounds of the new language is even greater than shifting accents. And so once you've had a system set in as a child and you've had certain sounds that exist in your language and may or may not exist in this new one, it's really an almost impossible task to learn these new sounds, and that's why it's really hard to lose an accent. You can be very, very fluent, but it's sort of, the odd person out that becomes native-like. And, of course, we hear about them because they're so unique. They're like unicorns, but they don't really exist very often.
I want to read this fact from the book. Out of the 800 or so possible speech sounds found across languages, we typically use about 20 to 40 in any one language. So those 20 to 40 are kind of probably baked in, like you said, by the time you reach a certain age. And then if you're trying to learn a new language where there's a new sound or they drop one of those other sounds, it's going to be tough no matter how good you get at the language. Let me bring in another caller now. This is Allison calling from LBI. Allison, you're on Studio 2. Would love to hear your accent perspective.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Queens, New York. So my accent now is nothing like my accent when I was growing up or with my family, partially because I worked overseas for over a decade. But I find, even though I'm in my 50s, that there are certain words I struggle to enunciate or pronounce. For instance, the 25-cent coin is, I grew up the way we said it was quota.
Yep.
But when I know it's supposed to be quarter or
No, you got it.
So it's like I go to like 1/4 or 25-cent coin a lot of times. And I was curious, like, if that's something that is prevalent in people whose accents have either been flattened out or changed basically because they moved to a different place, if there is that struggle to pronounce certain words that are different from how you were raised.
That's a great question. Valerie, do you want to take that? Because I actually did want to get into the sort of disappearing R, the New York, the Boston accent, and the British accent. But real quick, is what Allison's describing common?
Yes, it is. You know, I think a lot of us have that experience where we moved as, you know, 19, 20-year-olds, and we had a lot of accent experience, and we might sort of reduce the local accents that we had growing up a lot, but there are still certain things we get hung up on. And it really depends on the type of feature that you're trying to get rid of. And, you know, in the word she's talking about, quarter, and I loved Allison's attempt to do it with the R, we're talking about something called roticity, which is not just, you know, the chicken you eat at dinner. It's actually whether or not you have an R at the end of words, basically. It's called post-vocalic R. And, you know, New York is famous for non-roticity or dropping its R. And so a lot of times, you know, that's something that's really low level and hard to stick back in there if it's not your native pattern. And quarter has not just one, but two. And so even if you've managed to reduce that in your speech, having it in two that are close together like that can really make it very hard to achieve in both cases. And I think that's why that particular word is so hard for her.
Let's talk about New York, Boston, British accent, the convergence of those three and roticity. I want to play this clip. This is Boston Globe reporter Emily Sweeney, who has been going viral recently on social media, basically because of her accent. She's talking about local news stories in Boston. This one is about a robbery of an $18 million mansion. Let's play that clip.
I interviewed the homeowner, Thomas Swan III, and he told me that the caretaker was forced around the house by gunpoint and was pistol whipped and was even dragged down the stairs by her hair at some points. Tom said it appeared that the intruder was familiar with the house. Several valuables were stolen, including a Porsche that was used to escape from the property. The car has since been recovered, but the suspect remains at large.
Okay, so the big question I have about the Boston accent, the New York accent, the British accent, because they have some similarities, is that the New York and Boston accent are associated with working class backgrounds. But the British R dropping in water is considered posh or quote unquote proper. Like how did that happen, Valerie?
You know, the story of R is one of the most understudied, amazing histories that we don't learn in school, but we really should, because it has a lot about not just, you know, our own history in terms of migration and coming from Britain, but also the way language works and what it says about class. So, you know, we think about R dropping in Britain as being sort of posh, but the reality is that it actually was considered a vulgar new upstart in pronunciation in the 18th century. And we actually didn't even really see much evidence of it at all until, you know, really in the 1700s. So when most of the early colonists to the New England colonies came in the 1600s, they brought their R's with them because R dropping wasn't yet a thing. And then it's not till the 19th century when it started to get posh in Britain. And that's probably because of some industrialization of Britain and sort of changing cultures and immigration that made class distinctions less remarked on. It's still remarked on, but less so than they had been. And then it was just so many people that dropped their R's, it became the prestige feature. And it wasn't till the 19th century that New Englanders, who modeled themselves off of sort of the cultural sort of cachet of London, picked it up and brought it to the New World. And so up to pretty much World War II, dropping an R was considered prestigious in the United States as well, because mm-hmm. it was kind of this high-end New England feature. And that's sort of how it spread to New York, because the New York is sort of a New England corridor of development as the settlers spread. But after World War II, it started to change to be more towards everyman speech, towards middle American. And that's really when Midwestern accents kind of rose up in prestige. And so R added in, having an R became the prestige feature. And so that's when we sort of start hearing it as less statusful in American accents.
It's amazing to watch those two trends go in different ways up the social ladder in two different continents. And it's sort of, it's a really important, I think, illustration of how there is a bit of an arbitrary nature to this, and social context matters quite a bit. I want to bring in another caller. This is Caroline from Philadelphia, who is on line 8. Caroline, you're on Studio 2. Real quickly, what's your question or comment?
Yes, thank you, Avi and Valerie. I've often been mocked for my voice. Some people say it sounds like I have a Philly accent. I was born in Philly and raised in Philly, and some people ask if I'm from New York, and there's very little you can do, obviously, to change your voice, and I personally don't see anything wrong with my voice, but I'm not hearing it the way other people hear it. And also, I was told I sounded like Kathy Bates, and my voice sounds very young, and I guess I should take that as a compliment.
Yeah.
So,
it's an important call.
I don't know. How do you hear it?
Well, I think it's beautiful, Caroline, but I think the...
Oh, well, thank you.
But I think the sort of broader point you're raising is the social value we attach to accents. And
right.
And so I want to get our expert, Valerie, to weigh in on that, because it's an interesting dynamic. I do think people who have an accent in this country that's considered working class, there are some positive attributes that people associate with authenticity. Obviously, the Boston Globe reporter we heard earlier, people love that. But if it's associated with an activity that we think should have a sense of authority around it, then sometimes people reject it. And I want to play this clip from NPR Weekend Edition host Aisha Roscoe, who has spoken about some of the flack she's received over the years for the sound of her Black and Southern accent. Here she is talking about criticism at a Vermont Public Radio event.
I appreciate and I recognize that a lot of people do not expect authority to sound like me. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on Gaza. They don't expect to hear my voice reporting on the president or what have you. And so if my voice expands what people think of when they think of authority, then I am very happy to do that, right? Like, I'm very happy to do that.
So that clip and that call in concert, Valerie, the way people attach social meaning to an accent depends a lot on the context in which that accent is being used. And there are real social consequences. Can you talk about some of them?
Absolutely. And you know what, first of all, it saddens me that there is still that kind of accent bias in the world, that we would just go up to someone and tell them we don't like their voice. Mm. You know what, it's stunning to me that that happens. The reality is, you know, every accent has a story, and all our accents are really the story of humanity. It's what bonds us, not just whether we have the same accent, which points to shared experience and friendship and commonality in the people we love, but also the idea that it's the same fundamental pressures that lead to all of our accents. And so really, it's a great story of something we all have in common. But yet we are so quick to judge people. And while there might be this natural tendency to notice accents that we're born with, that doesn't mean it's a natural tendency to judge accents. That's something that's very much sort of socially learned. And we pass down these ideas we have about accents. And we notice that children very early on not only are attracted to people that sound more like their own accent, but we also find that they're attracted to people that talk with accents that are considered prestigious wherever they are.
Right.
So it seems
and that's
like
what's interesting to me, too, the way, like in this country, some people consider like a British accent to sound fancy, or even like a French accent to sound fancy. Real quickly, how does that develop? Because that's a situation where we're not part of that group. It's not an in-group accent, and yet we do have a positive association with it. How does something like that develop? We have about a minute.
You know, a lot of that's from sort of the historical associations and also the representation and sort of images in media. And so, you know, Emily in Paris is a fun show and it's kind of sexy. And so we love that French accent. And we sort of have a little bit of colonial angst about our relationship with Britain. And I think that sort of elevates that accent in our eyes. But things that we don't think of as highly, which is often the working class accent, they tend to get associated with, you know, sort of negative stereotypes about being lazy or uneducated. But also the warmth and love of family. So there's always positive and negatives to all these.
I want to thank you, Valerie Friedland, for your time today. I wish we could do another hour, honestly. We have so many comments and calls we couldn't get to. But thank you for your book, Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. Valerie Friedland, professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada. Appreciate the time on Studio 2.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And now it's time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song. Hit it. I like that. Never heard that song before. It's called Words by Missing Persons from 1982. Thank you to John P. from Shillington, PA for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day. One more comment to read before we get out of here. Betty wants to hear me, Avi, say three words. Mary, Mary, and the name Mary. Take from that what you will, Betty, and everyone else listening. We so appreciated your time this week on Studio 2. And of course, let me thank our producers, Debbie Builder and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt, and I love the way you talk. We'd love to hear you again next week when we come back for more Studio 2.